If I am fully cognizant that I am not only the one remaining barrier to lunch, but I'm also the remaining barrier to home. And so while I don't know if I can vouch for the level of fun that this next 30 minutes will be, at least I have great sympathy, and I will try to make it as interesting as possible. A little bit of background. My name is Johnny Lin. I'm currently teaching in Computing and Software Systems Division at the University of Washington's Bothell campus, one of the three branch campuses or campuses of the University of Washington system, not the one you probably all know, which is the one that's located in Seattle. You might be wondering why someone who is in CS is talking about environmental ethics, and then the answer to that is I'm actually a relative newcomer to CS. I joined this department only 2 years ago. Before that, I was a physicist, but my training my PhD is in atmospheric sciences, in climate dynamics, that kind of thing. And before that, I worked as a hydrologist doing wetland restoration type of stuff. And my master's is in civil engineering hydrology. So I actually have more formal training and background in environmental science. But nonetheless, some people have allowed me to get close to a computer, and there's all sorts of bad things that have now resulted, and that's where I am. So this particular, here's the outline, but before I kind of go into this outline, let me sort of set the stage for why this particular topic. And basically, through the years that I've been involved with environmental issues, I've observed that oftentimes, in a discussion with someone will say, well, the science about this particular issue says this, this, and this. And therefore, we need to do policy A. Or, if you're in a Christian context, someone say, well, God has told us that we need to be stewards of the environment. Scripture says this. Therefore, we have to do policy B. And it always seemed a little bit funny to me that between what Scripture says and what science says and what policies that particular person was recommending, there was this whole sort of unsaid area of beliefs and assumptions that were never elucidated. And one of the results, it seemed to me at least, being that people could hold the exact same positions in this area and yet come up with totally different policy recommendations over on this end. And so for the last several years, I've been interested in trying to tease out and put together a framework with which one could essentially take those unsaid assumptions and beliefs and make them apparent, to bring them out to be explicitly considered. Behind this, the working hypothesis that I have is that a lot of the disagreements, or at least a fair amount of the disagreements between people with regards to what policies one should enact to be a faithful steward of creation, are the result of those unsaid and implicit assumptions and beliefs that are connecting faith and science to whatever the policy conclusions are. And so I've created a taxonomy of what I'm calling considered obedience, and trying to use that to essentially, you know, bring those assumptions out to the light, with the hope that that people who then disagree on policies are able to have dialogue about the places that are really fueling their disagreements, maybe be able to find points of compromise and be able to move forward on that. Okay, so that's sort of the overall picture of that. After talking about this taxonomy in a little bit, I'll talk about the nature of worldviews and the nature of science epistemology and of science policy connections. You'll see in this taxonomy that I present that there's more than these two particular issues that are part of what I think go into the translation of faith and science into policy on environmental issues, but these are the ones that I'm going to be talking about today. And then I'll just talk about then, once we've examined that nature, what are some of the effects with regards to that translation into policy. Okay, so I start out by making an argument that if you have a command, so let's say the command to steward the earth, but you know, outside of a Christian context, this could also be you know, a moral command that you know by reason if you take a Kantian approach or something like that, that in order to obey a command, you need to have clarity in three criteria. And the criteria are the importance of the command, the goals of the command, and the practices of the command. So in terms of the importance of the command, here what I mean is this something optional, or is it a duty? Is it something that has contextual differences? One context, it might have one status, and another might have a different status. Is there some sort of hierarchy of commands? Okay. Even within the Christian context, we know that the commands that God gives, while they are all commands that we are to do, nonetheless, that there's also a hierarchy there. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. On these, all the law and the prophets hang. So that, now, whether this hierarchy means one trumps the other or supplants the other, that's part of what it means to examine the importance of a command, is to understand what is the nature of that. But my mere point is just to say something is a command does not mean that every command automatically has the exact same status and the exact same in every single possible condition. Okay, so that's what I mean here about examining importance. With regards to the goals of the command, here we're talking about what are you trying to accomplish. So, for instance, with regards to environmental issues, are you looking to restore some particular area of land to before human settlement, to the condition or the functioning, the dynamics before human settlement? Or are you trying to restore, is the goal to maximize ecosystem complexity of some sort, or to maximize species protection? Or, what exactly is the resulting aim for whatever practices you eventually want to, put into effect to implement the command that you've been given? Okay. And then the third one, in terms of practices, even though in a lot of sort of contentious debates on environmental issues, it seems like the number of practices are very, very limited. In reality, there could be a whole wide range of different practices. Well, what are they? What are the possible things that you could do to obey the command? In order to examine that and to have clarity in that, I'm also arguing is required to be able to make this translation. So my argument is that for creation care, as well as I think this particular taxonomy, I think can be useful for commands outside of creation care. Right now, for a faith science symposium that North Park University is holding at the end of September, I'm working on a paper that extends the framework to more practical, in some ways, everyday sort of decisions. Decisions like, what should I wear today? Or I mean, that was more for a joke. That's not really what we. I would never go through all these things to try and figure out what I'm going to wear today. But the point being that there are a lot of other sort of practical everyday decisions that one could apply the framework. But in the case of creation care, and certain, I'm making the argument that the three criteria that I've just outlined, how is it that those are determined? Well, I'm suggesting that this suite of determinants are at least the first cut of places we need to look at. So in terms of worldview, literally there, I mean, when you see the world, what is it? Is it just matter in motion? Is it something that is primarily accessed by aesthetics? Is it a monist worldview in which all there is existence, so something Eastern Buddhist, that kind of view? Literally, what is it when you see nature, when you see the world? Ethical theories, I think are relatively self-explanatory, but certainly deontology, utilitarianism, virtue ethics, natural law, all those schools of ethics that we have thousands of years of philosophers to thank for and have really, can help us to think through what has value and how to weigh different values with one another. Science epistemology, how do we know in science? And that I'll be focusing on today. Science policy connections, so the entire field of science policy studies has done some really amazing work in the last several decades with regards to that question of, you've got the science, you want to get to policy, what is the path by which you go, and what are the different possible ways, the roles that science could play upon that path. And that's something we'll be focusing on today, too. Politics and economics, how we organize our common life, whether it be in terms of responsibilities to one another or in terms of economic production, in terms of finance, of money, and productivity. And into all these determinants, scripture, reason, et cetera, are part of that input. Unfortunately, most of the time when we talk about creation care, we only cover a few of these determinants. And so part of my argument, sort of the broad argument that I'm making, is we need to consider all of them if we're going to be able to have a dialogue as opposed to a shouting match with one another about what it is that we should do to take care of creation. Okay, now here's my commercial. I have to, and it is totally shameless. Over the last 5 years or so, I've been thinking about this. I've presented a number of the ideas on this topic at different ASA annual meetings. And finally, in February this year, I made a book, or the book came out. And so the source for a lot of today's discussion is going to be can be found here. And in this text, I cover all the determinants, not just the three that I'm talking about today. And it's the nature of environmental stewardship, understanding creation care solutions. Pickwick is the, which is an imprint of Wittgenstock, is my publisher. To get the book table at this meeting, which will close at the talk at the end of my talk, so you can't get the book at the book table at this meeting anymore. But there's a free chapter on the book's website, and I stuck a little pile of flyers right at the door, not in back, but at the door. And so, if you're interested, you can pick that up and see the very kind words that Terry Morrison gave for blurbing the book. And again, like I said today, I'm not going to talk about all the determinants, but just worldviews and science epistemology. Okay. So, worldviews. Like I said before, worldviews are fundamentally about when you see the world, what is it that you see? When you see nature, what is it that you see? And you can break down sort of what kind of questions worldviews answer into these 5 points. Questions of reality, origin, condition, solution, and destiny with regards to nature, with regards to human beings, and the role of human beings within nature. I'm just gonna go on. Okay. Now, in the Christian worldview, this is probably a reasonably, at least I hope it's a reasonably fair summary of the Christian worldview from the standpoint of a focus on creation care. You know, obviously, the Christian world, usually we use the worldview in actually a broader context than I'm using it today. Today, it's really, like I said, when you see the world, what do you see? But with regards to that question, I think we could fairly argue that the Christian worldview tells us that the universe is created by a good and transcendent God, and God is not far away, even though God is not creation itself, is transcendent and outside of creation, but it, at the same time, is also immanent and not far away, and continues to sustain creation. Secondly, that the universe is material, but that it's not only material or merely material, that materiality is somehow some sort of existence that's apart from God, but rather in some mysterious, maybe not so mysterious, but at least in some way, that that God is still connected with this materiality, as well as the non-material parts of nature. So when we talk about non-material, we could talk about those in terms of intelligences like of angels, so in angelology, but we could also talk about it in terms of transcendentals, so love, truth, beauty. Now, I'm not saying that all Christians necessarily believe transcendentals have existential status, but at the same time, that is one way of understanding what one means by not merely material. that a Christian worldview historically has had at least the components of both to it. Okay. Third, that creation is best understood through worshiping the Creator. That we're charged to be stewards, as the last speaker talked about, as AJ mentioned. And then finally, that the destiny of creation is not stasis, is not its current state, but rather there will be a redemption of it, in addition to a redemption of the human part of creation too, and that there will be a restoration. Okay, now if we looked at a range of worldviews, we find that there are, as one might expect, a variety of ways of looking at what we see when we see nature. So from a Buddhist perspective, and you'll notice in this particular list that some of these worldviews are religious, but some of them are also secular. Worldviews do not have to be religious. Everyone has a worldview. You see something when you see nature. People often associate, religion certainly plays a large role. So from a Buddhist perspective, a monist perspective, all you have is existence, and so there is ultimately no real sort of ontological or being separation between nature and human beings, or for that matter, between anything and anything else, right? Between a table and a human and a cat and a microbe. All that there is existence. And in the Buddhist mindset, the part of what it means for the goal of humanity or for a human being is to break out of this idea that the ego is actually substantial, that the idea of an I is actually real. You have to connect with the reality that all is actually one. Okay. From a Confucian perspective, in that perspective, the world is all there is. But the Confucian view considers there's this interrelationship between human beings and nature that has echoes of Buddhism, but instead of it being focused on an existential monism, instead the idea is that human beings are like an elder brother to the world, to nature. And within the Confucian context, it's not elder sibling, it's elder brother, because within that particular tradition, there's specific meaning to elder brotherhood. As the firstborn son in my, as the firstborn and only son in my family, it is not the same as if I had been female, in terms of what a Chinese family dynamic would look like. It's not equivalent. Okay, and so that really owes itself to Confucian context. Taoism, the world is also all there is, but the response is that human beings have to live in harmony with nature, but that harmony means going with the flow. It means not posing any kind of resistance. Neo-Enlightenment, matter and motion, and a romantic worldview. The last two are secular, are not religious, but in the romantic worldview, nature is best understood via aesthetics. Okay. So what do worldviews then provide? So what I would say here, these are some more specific points, but I think the main thing that I would point out is that worldviews are in general not prescriptive of actions. That when you think about those particular descriptions that I've just given of a worldview, that doesn't necessarily lead to, therefore you must do practice A or do practice B. That so, for instance, with regards to the Taoism tells us that we need to be in harmony with nature, but it doesn't tell us what the square footage of the windows in our homes need to be. So the prescriptiveness of policy based on worldviews has limitations. So what is it then that worldviews do provide? Well, first of all, with regards to the importance criteria, worldviews provide a framework that will limit what can or should be considered. So if you have a concept, for instance, of personhood that is monist, that will provide a very different, everything is one in terms of existence, that will provide a very different kind of framework with regards to what you should consider if you have a purpose-driven concept of personhood. A second way that worldviews provide input with regards to the importance criterion is that I think that worldviews provide a preference for protecting what I'm calling valuables and the value of different kinds of ontological forms. So if you have romantic worldview and you see the world, not necessarily a romantic one, but if you see nature as the work of a master craftsman, then that will key into the kinds of ways one thinks about works of art and what one would do to take care of a work of art or the importance of taking care of a work of art. So I'm saying that a worldview conditions our understanding of importance in light of this desire to protect something valuable that the worldview is suggests exists. Okay? And then worldviews that also provide motivation for the goals of creation care, certainly within the context of ethical frameworks that a lot of worldviews provide. However, like I mentioned earlier, that worldviews don't generally prescribe actions. They tend to be nonspecific and non-deterministic. I won't talk that much about this, but the main point here is that when you have a worldview, if you don't have ethics, then you're not able to, you need something more, and that's what ethics provides. So how much time do I have?
You're up against.
I'm guessing, okay, so it's not 11:45.
No, but we need time for questions.
Okay, so I'm going to go really, really fast in the next thing. Okay, so the main point here about epistemology, and I can actually just summarize it really quick, is that there are multiple ways of understanding the authority. If you take a social constructionist view versus a very high view of science, the classical hypothesis testing model, then you can see that your view of what science's authority is will be different. Okay, and then with regards to science policy models, let me just summarize. One view of science policy is that science directly dictates policy and values don't play a role in this. And this would be called a policy prescriptive model. A second one understands science as being about the facts, and those facts are channeled into policymakers who then apply values to them. So science is seen as being value-free. Then you apply values to them, and from that, you get some sort of policy. This I call the fact-dualism model. In the supporting role model, you have a whole bunch of different types of values, different stakeholders, and they combine with science as being some sort of quasi-neutral player that is able to allow these different stakeholders to communicate to one another, and that results in policy. This I'm calling the supporting role science is neutral model. Another role of how science could play is you have different values, and science is also just a value that has no epistemic authority relative to any other value. It's just one other stakeholder, one other input, and that combines together into policy. And I'm calling this the supporting role science may not be neutral model. And a final particular model called the honest broker of policy alternatives model. The basic idea there is that science's role in this model is to expand the range of policy options rather than to constrict them. And that's what that, in theory, shows. And so you can see that these particular models can be grouped on the basis of epistemic authority, that if you believe science has high epistemic authority, you might tend towards a policy prescriptive or a fact-value dualism model. If you believe that science is unique in certain ways, but less unique than is commonly believed, you might choose these models. If you don't believe science is unique at all, then you might choose that particular model. And if you look in terms of science policy studies, you'll see examples of each of these models being played out. And so when you are looking at the role that worldviews in epistemology plays in selecting one science policy framework, as you might expect, you would ask questions like, does science only give us knowledge of the material? How material is nature? If you think nature is really material and science is restricted to the material, well, then there's a nice connection. And lastly, what kind of authority does science have? So if you believe science has a lot of authority, nature is material, and science just talks about the material, then that would prime one to say, okay, let's use a policy prescriptive model. But if you have different other land on those questions in different ways, you might choose a different model. Okay. And so I'll end there. So my basic conclusion is that when we take a look at worldviews, epistemology, and science policy models, that those all play this, that they're all involved, and those will condition the kind of policies that we're willing to look at and how we connect the science and the worldviews to those policies. Okay, thanks. Terry, and then Craig.
I just bought your book on Kindle.
Oh,
while you were talking.
High technology at its best, right?
So in my non-majors chemistry class, we do a unit on global warming, CO2, atmospheric chemistry, and so on. And I usually wrap it up with something like, science doesn't tell us what to do.
Mm-hmm.
It just mm-hmm. tells us the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
And that uh-huh. you, these liberal arts, mm-hmm. non-science major students, are going to be the ones that have to think about
right.
what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a whole range of, you know, economics,
right.
sociology, mm-hmm. You know, values, whatever.
Right.
I mean, is that... I mean, you know, that's one of your
right. well,
perspectives.
If,
but
right.
I mean, are you suggesting that, you know, we sort of need to recognize that and that's
uh-huh.
the way we ought to proceed forward?
Well, so the first thing I would say is that that idea that you've just described is not only one of those models. It's actually out of the five that I listed, four of those models. The first model, policy prescriptive model, is actually not what you said. In that model, the scientists are that should be the policymakers, and all we have to do is to get the best science and apply that into whatever policymaking realm we have, and then we will achieve whatever it is that we want to achieve.
Yeah, but why does mm-hmm. science? Why would science tell us what we want or what should be?
Well, so in that particular model, this, essentially science is understood as having very high epistemic authority. And so because it tells us what the right answer is, then we should defer our judgment to it. So, but my point, though, is that there's two points. First is that there are many people who believe that model. And so you may tell your students that, you know, the liberal arts people really need to play a role, but they're going to encounter people that don't actually believe that believe the other one. And we see this in politics all the time when people talk about, well, the reason we need to do this policy is it's based upon the best science. Or, you know, and it doesn't matter what side you're on, that appeal to the authority of science is huge. So that model, you know, has a lot of currency. But then with the second thing I would say is with regards to your discussion with your students, is that the way that we have values enter into dialogue with science to get policy, one of the things I'm claiming is that there are multiple ways of doing that. And how you do that is determined, first of all, how you choose that will depend upon what sort of understanding you have of what science is, as well as, you know, worldviews, et cetera. So, Craig and then Sam. Uh-huh.
Yesterday, there was another really good talk, Kevin Siebel, Cultural Psychology, Why Can't We All Just Get Along? And his was more about psychology. And you've done a really excellent job of what is the culture for these questions and how is it connected to psychology, and not to sociology, mm-hmm. too, of course. So thanks.
No, thanks, sir. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a follow-up on your question, which is that the complexity of our world right now, we can see it in our, in this country and all over,
mm-hmm.
is that the social sciences is part of the sciences. What are the policies that can be done now that mm-hmm. that because of the complexity of psychology, sociology, I think it's going to take those scientists to figure out what the consequences are for what the best policies are.
Consequences sociologically and psychologically?
Which, uh-huh. how do we get the folks who are going to be voting in November uh-huh. to make good decisions? We
uh-huh.
need to know what the consequences of different decisions are.
Right.
And that's
uh-huh.
what the social scientists might be able to tell
right.
us. So
yeah.
that's still science.
Yeah. Well, so folks who are you know, who are involved in science policy studies, I think a number of people would call themselves social scientists. And so to the extent that one can, I mean, I guess maybe when I use the word science, I mean natural science.
Yeah, I know. That's,
yeah. So yeah. So you know, I think that's yeah. that's definitely fair. So but yeah, those the questions that social scientists are trying to frame for us to help us to understand how do we go from A to B. Are incredibly valuable, and I would suggest that this is one attempt of trying to help make that explicit and help there to be dialogue. Matthew?
Last question.
Okay, thanks.
All right, you got a lot of stuff really well kind of broken down, and I like that. one question I have, kind of a challenge, and you may completely disagree, but it seems at first glance to me that the first model science prescripting policy is really just one of the other models in disguise. So what do you think? Because that is often, I mean, you hear that presentation that you just said a minute ago all the time of, you know, science says we should do this, and they're saying science is authority, but what they're, it's really a disguise for science plus this set of values is telling us to do that. So, so I mean, what's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly, I think that's the case. I mean, there's a science policy researcher at University of Colorado named Roger Pilkey Jr. Who actually proposed the honest broker model, but he talks about stealth issue advocacy, where as one way that scientists are interjected into some sort of environmental controversy, where the appearances of, well, I'm just saying what the science says, but they're really working as an issue advocate, and it's stealth because that advocacy isn't acknowledged as being, you know, I'm actually taking an advocacy position, and then there are other patterns too. But yeah, I think that certainly does happen, and regardless of what side of a position you fall on.
Right.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.